Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight I'll be talking about the Qatif demonstrations in 1979 that happened in one of the poorer areas of Saudi Arabia. With the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran, it inspired certain Shias in the region to try and secure equal treatment given to the Sunnis. Now, a large conglomeration of Shias lived near oil refineries. I think it starts with a G, Jahan or something like that. Since Al-Hasa and Qatif were conquered and annexed as the Emirate Riyadh in 1913 by Ibn Saud, Shias in the region had experienced state oppression. Unlike most of Saudi Arabia, Qatif and much of the eastern province has a Shiite majority, and the region is also one of the key important areas of the Saudi government due to the fact that it processes most of the oil reserves and is the main refinery and export terminal in Ras Tanura, which is situated close to Qatif. Furthermore, despite possessing the bulk of the oil which funds the Saudi state, the region has traditionally been neglected by the central government and left undeveloped, with priorities given to the Sunni majority area. The region was lagging in respect to health care. Shiite Aramco workers were also paid less than Sunnis, leading to increased anti-Western feelings. When Americans were going in and out of the Dhahran Air Force Base for maneuvers, the Shiites organized a big demonstration beginning on November 11, 1979. Now, this is rather a disturbing event in the Saudi Arabian history, given the fact that, you know, a lot of the media coverage in that area is not open to the rest of the world. And it's possible that there was a lot of suppression that an unfamiliarity, except for intelligence, that knew about it. I want to bring out another interesting fact. King Khalid was the king of Saudi Arabia in 1979. He had taken Faisal's place, who was killed by his own nephew in 1975. And Prince Nayef, who is number two in command right now in Saudi Arabia in 2015, was the interior minister at the time. Also, Prince Abdullah, who was the governor of the eastern province, I don't know if that's the same prince that just died recently as the Saudi prime minister, or king, I should say. Now, you have to understand that the Islamic Revolution was one of the most pivotal events in the Middle East in the last 50 years, because it was a situation where the religious state overtook any form of secular government, and the Westerners who had supported the Shah of Iran through modernization, that was completely wiped out, and the clerics, the Ayatollahs, took over. Not only that, but they embarrassed the Americans by keeping American hostages for over a year. Now, encouraged by a march in Safwa, protests spread to other parts of the Qatif area. First, there was a demonstration in late November in which 4,000 Shias took to the streets publicly to celebrate the Day of Ashura. Now, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia does not recognize Shia holidays and festivals. So the fact that on November 25th, 1975, 4,000 Shias took to the streets and celebrated in a non-discreet manner was an abrasion to the empire. Encouraged by the march in Safwa, protests spread to other parts of the Qatif area, and on the evening of the 26th of November, thousands took to the streets of Sahar, close to Daman. Protesters shouted anti-regime slogans demanding the abdication of the king, and the protesters advanced on a near group of National Guardsmen who had been deployed to that area. The violent confrontation with Saudi security forces was led from the protest, ending and by Hussein Mansour al-Kaif. He was a recent graduate of Aramco's Industrial Training Center. Aramco is the Saudi-U.S. Oil Corporation. The Saudi National Guardsmen initially controlled the crowd through the use of clubs and electric prods, which angered the crowd and was met by protesters throwing stones and wielding bars and wooden canes as weapons. The National Guardsmen then opened fire on the crowd, wounding others, including the 19-year-old worker I just mentioned, Hussein Mansour al-Kaif. Kaif was rushed to the local Saudi Aramco Medical Services place by fellow protesters, but was refused treatment. I'm not going to read anymore. I'm going to just discuss Hussein Mansour al-Kaif, who was a young man, only 19. There were 182 to 219 deaths within a four-year period involving these types of protesters. There were hundreds of injuries and thousands were arrested, and I'm pretty sure a few were put to death. Following the initial protests and clashes, there were numerous other skirmishes between protesters and state security forces, mostly in the Qatif area. Now, I'm going to digress a minute, and what I'm going to discuss is the nature of Saudi Arabian politics. Because I'm also going to discuss a secret deal in the book between Israel and the Saudi, couple businessmen that were below the radar of official government business that was going to create havoc in the area. Now, Saudi Arabia is situated near Israel, and it also Yemen and Oman flank it on the southern border. I will get to that in a second. Now, as you know, over the last 30 years, there's been much more upheaval of Saudi Arabia and the surrounding area, not within the kingdom, but in the surrounding area. The Syrian war has created a big problem. Saudi Arabia is not a proponent of Bashar al-Assad in Syria. They are against him. They are also fearful of Iran, and they are not a supporter of pure Shia rule. One of their kings, Faisal, who ruled up until 1975, from 64 to 75, believed in inclusion in the Islamic race, inclusion of Saudi and Shias and Sunnis. Now, in the case of the uprising, the Qatif uprising in 1979, there was not fair play as far as how the Shias were treated as opposed to the Sunnis. But in other parts of the kingdom where people perhaps weren't as poor and oppressed, there was probably more evenness. Now, I want to talk about the topography of the area for a minute. So Saudi Arabia is a Western ally, and it's one of the largest. It's probably half the size of Europe. And they have the United Arab Emirates, Oman, and Yemen on the on the southern border. Now, as you know, the Yemeni's president was recently ousted, and there was an uprising there. And also with the Syrian war and refugees piling into Turkey, Iraq, Jordan, and other places, the ISIS has taken advantage of the instability in the region. Now, Saudi Arabia and Israel have no formal relations, but some of their wealthy business partners have ties. Now, if you look across the Bay of the Red Sea, there's Egypt and Sudan. And in 1981, Saudi Arabia made a secret arms deal with the Sudanese. They also included, I believe it was a Nigerian or a Kenyan, in the deal, and I will discuss that in a moment. Now, Saudi Arabia is very pragmatic in their foreign relations diplomacy. They don't always automatically take the side of the Islamic world. Their vision of a pan-Arabic state is more pragmatic. It's more of a cooperation within the region, and it doesn't always align with extremists. However, I believe it was during the rule from 1953 to 64, where one of the brothers took an extremist from Egypt because they were being criticized by Nasser for not being pro-Islamic enough. So they took some of the rejects from Egypt who were... Egypt is a center for intellectual discourse, and Egypt didn't want some of the radical Islamic scholars, so Saudi Arabia took them. Okay, now I'm going to read a passage from a book that I found in a personal biography called Eric, The Life of Ariel Sharon. I found this passage in the book. Despite the American cold shoulder, Ariel Sharon maintained that the memorandum it was 1981, so I'm gonna start one paragraph earlier. So they're talking about Menachem Begin relationships with President Ronald Reagan. This is after Reagan took over. On an official visit to Washington with Menachem Begin in September 1981, the Prime Minister asked Ronald Reagan if Sharon might brief the American side with some ideas that might give form to the relationship between the two countries. Sam Lewis, a long-serving ambassador to Israel, provided a graphic recollection of what happened. Reagan agreed to have the meeting, so Sharon stood up with a set of maps of the Middle East and proceeded to give an absolutely hair-raising description of the ways the Israeli Defense Forces, the IDF, could be of assistance to the U.S. in contingency situations. It would have taken Israel as far east as Iran, as far north as Turkey. I could see Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger blanch visibly. Everyone on the American side was shocked by the grandiose scope of the Sharon concept for strategic cooperation. It included the use of Israeli forces to assist the U.S. in the case of uprising in Gulf Emirates. I'm going to skip over that for a second. I want to check to see if I have any callers. Nope, not at this time. So I'm going to go back to the book. The formal purpose of Begin's visit was to begin discussions on a memorandum of agreement of strategic cooperation between the two countries. Sharon, at this period in time, made a tour of several African countries, and he wove his experiences in Gabon, Central African Republic, Zaire, and South Africa into an ongoing strategic dialogue with the Pentagon. Israel, he suggested, could be helpful in Africa too in combating Libyan subversion and countering Soviet influence. Weinberger's team remained unimpressed. Begin monitoring the talks from Jerusalem ignored the American lack of enthusiasm. For him, in Lewis's words, that signed piece of paper was much more important than the content. He wanted a symbol of the alliance. Eventually, a document was drawn up in practical content. Sharon and the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Yitzhak Shamir, visiting Washington together in November of 81, attended the signing ceremony, which Weinberger contrived to hold in the basement of the Pentagon without media coverage. Despite the American cold shoulder, Sharon maintained that the memorandum was significant, though not a vehicle for joint Israeli-American activities of that kind. I had been recommending to the Secretary of State, Alexander Haig and Weinberger. It did acknowledge explicitly the threat of Soviet-inspired military activity in the region and provided channels for closer military and intelligence coordination between the two countries. He never tired of unfurling his maps and delivering his briefings on Israel's role as a regional superpower and as America's strong and willing surrogate. Foreign statesmen, Israeli politicians, military men, academians, and journalists all were treated to his sweeping presentations during the period. I want to point something out. I'm stopping in the middle of the book. Saddam Hussein wanted to become a regional hegemon in the Middle East. Nasser, who was a very charismatic and powerful, Nasser, the prime commander of Egypt, was one of the only few successful regional hegemons in the area. I believe that Ariel Sharon had militaristic aspirations, but he wasn't that well received because of his militance. Back to the book. One far-fetched scheme which was kept out of the briefings involved two Israeli business friends of Sharon and their Saudi American partner, who were to supply large quantities of American arms to Sudan. They were to serve the son of the exiled Shah of Iran to mount a revolt against the Ayatollahs who had been taken over the country of Iran. The arms would also be useful to foment rebellion against Libya's Muammar Gaddafi. There was a clandestine meeting. Sudan and Israel had no formal diplomatic relations, but it took place in May of 1982 in Kenya between Ariel Sharon and Lilly and the Sudanese leader Jafar Numeri. Also present were two Israeli businessmen, the Saudi partner, and the Director General of the Israeli Foreign Ministry, David Kemichi, who recently resigned from the Mossad. Perhaps it was fortunate that the Lebanon War intervened before this particular piece of megalomania could get off the ground. What they mean by the Lebanese War in 1982, there was a turbulent war, and remember, almost 300 to 400 American Marines were blown up in the Lebanese barracks. No African adventures or Asian wars resulted from Begin's posturing and Sharon's strategic bombast. They are important, though, as indicators of the two men's shared mood as they conceived the Israeli strategy that led to the Lebanese War. They both revealed an Israel military power and potential recovered now after the Yom Kippur setback. They both regarded Israel as an outpost of American power in the global confrontation with the Soviet bloc and its Arab satellites, and they were both convinced that the Reagan team fundamentally saw things the same way. Did they both, in their exhilarated assessment of Israel's capabilities and American sympathies, conceive a sweeping military move designed not only to defeat the PLO and Syrians in Lebanon and install a pro-Israel government there, but to also drive Palestinians from Lebanon to Jordan, where they would overthrow the king and set up their own state. Sharon, as we have seen, has long believed that the regime change in Amman was the key to solving the Palestinian problem. Some of his critics suspected him of harboring this undeclared agenda when he launched the Lebanese War. Now, I know at one point a lot of the Palestinians were deported to Jordan and other places like Yemen, and they had little choice. I guess this proves one of the theories that power brokering in the Middle East can be decided by rich businessmen that can make private deals and shift arms from place to place, not that much different than the Contra-Iran affair in America when Oliver North traded arms for hostages. Now, I'm going to look up this Lebanese war thing a second. Hold on. And then we'll go back to the dynamics of the Middle East. Now, Israel is always on the offensive in the sense that they don't feel secure. But as you can see, Israel and Saudi Arabia are both fearful. Saudi Arabia dislikes Russia for supporting over the last 25 years the Bashar al-Assad regime and his father. And Israel dislikes Soviets too because they supplied a lot of the engines and tanks in the 1973 Yom Kippur War, and they were a disturbance to Israel. In 1982, the Lebanese War, it was called Operation Peace for Galilee by Israel and later known in Israel as the Lebanon War, began on June 6, 1982, when Israel Defense Forces invaded southern Lebanon. The military operation was launched after gunmen from Abu Nidal's organization attempted to assassinate Shlomo Argov, Israel's ambassador to the UK. Prime Minister Menachem Begin blamed Abu Nidal's enemy, the PLO, for the incident and used the incident as a pretext for the invasion. Begin returned to the operation as self-defense to avoid another Treblinka. Treblinka is a connotation for an extermination camp built by Nazi Germany. Checking for callers. No callers this time of night. So as we look at the region, by the way, before I get back into the reading, as we look into the region, we see that military tactics have to be projected to hone in. There's always been the Hezbollah situated in Lebanon. Syria occupied Lebanon for over 10 years. And governments, when planning their military strategy, have to take in the submission of extreme Islamic groups as well as the position that the Jews have in protecting themselves and how they're perceived by other Islamic states. After attacking the PLO as well as the Syrian leftist and Muslim Lebanese forces, Israel occupied southern Lebanon, eventually surrounding the PLO and elements of the Syrian army. Surrounded in West Beirut and subjected to heavy bombardment, the PLO forces and their allies negotiated passage from Lebanon with the aid of the U.S. Special Envoy Philip Habib and the protection of international peacekeepers. The PLO, under the chairmanship of Yasser Arafat, had relocated its headquarters to Tripoli in June of 1982. For any of you out there who are unaware, Tripoli is, I believe, in Libya. By expelling the PLO, removing Syrian influence over Lebanon, and installing a pro-Israeli Christian government led by Bashir Gemayel, G-E-M-A-Y-E-L, Bashir Gemayel, Israel hoped to sign a treaty with Menachem Begin, their leader, promised would give Israel 40 years of peace. The long occupation that followed Israel's 1982 invasion had repercussions for Israel, with the Hezbollah being conceived to fight the Israeli occupation. Following the assassination of Lebanese President Bashir Gemayel, that's too bad he got killed, Israel's position in Beirut became untenable and the signing of a peace treaty became increasingly unlikely. Outrage followed Israel's role in the Falangus perpetuated Sabra and Shatila massacre of mostly Palestinians and Lebanese Shiites, and Israel's popular disillusionment with war would lead to a gradual withdrawal from Beirut to southern Lebanon, which was initiated following the 17th of May agreement and Syria's change of attitude towards the PLO. After Israel had left most of Lebanon, the war of the camps broke out between Lebanese factions. The PLO in Syria, in which Syria fought over its former Palestinian allies. At the same time, Shia militant groups began consolidating and waging a low-intensity guerrilla war over the Israeli occupation of southern Lebanon, leading to an 18 years of low-scale armed conflict. The Lebanese civil war would continue until 1990, at which point Syria had established complete dominance over Lebanon. And actually, I have a friend from Lebanon. She lives in Duluth, and she said that the Syrians occupied that area for over 10 years. They're very invasive, and they've also increased the possibility of terrorism in the region, with the PLO contesting with the Hezbollah. Okay, so this is kind of the pretext of terrorist organizations taking over the legitimacy of the government. I'm going to give myself a break. Listen in.
From ABC News, great TV news stories with Peter Jennings. Sam Donaldson, Barbara Walters, Geraldo Rivera, Frank Reynolds, Richard Trelkell, Pierre Salinger, John Scalley, and the worldwide resources of ABC News.
ABC News has learned that Israeli armed forces have completed preparations for a military attack in the Lebanon, and U.S. officials believe will strike within a few days, probably this weekend. High administration officials have been alerted that Prime Minister Begin is on the brink of giving his forces a go-ahead, using as an explanation the assassination of an Israeli diplomat in Paris last Saturday. However, it's suspected at the highest level here that an Israeli decision to attack is time to take advantage of the U.S. preoccupation with the Falkland Islands crisis. At least two Israeli divisions have been spotted by U.S. satellite and other intelligence poised for an attack along the Lebanese border. Their position could foreshadow either the long-feared massive attack or a smaller invasion which would aim only at PLO installations in southern Lebanon. If the larger attack develops, some U.S. officials believe Israeli troops would seek to advance all the way to Beirut's outskirts while simultaneously attacking Syrian missiles positioned in the Bekaa Valley.
Good evening. The stillness of the ceasefire in southern Lebanon was shattered today by the sound of guns, bombs, and planes. Peter Jennings is at our foreign desk in London. Peter?
Frank, this afternoon the Israeli Air Force attacked a variety of targets in Lebanon. It wasn't the massive raid which much of the world has been expecting and which the United States has been trying to prevent. It was, however, an attack with major political implications. In the first of two reports, here is ABC Jacques Grenier in Beirut.
The Israeli jets flew over Lebanon for about 2 hours, concentrating their attacks on four Palestinian positions. The Palestinians responded with anti-aircraft guns and heat-seeking surface-to-air missiles. But the planes were too high for the guns and dropped decoy flares to attract the missiles. Israeli bombs and rockets killed at least 25 people. Many more were wounded. Ambulances carried the casualties to Beirut, about 10 miles from the most intensive bombing. The rockets and bombs fell, for the most part, on Palestinian military positions. Reporters were kept away. The raids put to rest the American-negotiated ceasefire between Israel and the Palestinians, which has held tenuously for the past 9 months. Palestinian spokesman tonight made that very clear.
Everybody around the world knows that this is a clear provocation and it's a violation and a breaching to the ceasefire which was agreed upon.
For several weeks now, Palestinian leaders have been predicting that Israel will invade southern Lebanon. Any retaliation by the Palestinians for today's air raids could provoke that very invasion. Jacques Grenier, ABC News, Beirut.
It's been a long time now that people on both sides of the Israeli-Palestinian divide have been waiting for an incident, something that would generate open conflict again between Israel and the Palestinians in Lebanon. That incident, the Israelis blame it on the PLO denied it, was a terrorist attack on Israel's ambassador in Britain last night. Within 24 hours, Israel and the Palestinians were attacking each other across the Israeli-Lebanese border. First, from Beirut, here's ABC's Chris Harper.
The Israeli attack was centered on Palestinian positions in Beirut, leaving over 30 people dead and scores injured. One key target was a sports arena, where Israel claimed the PLO was storing its weapons. Eyewitnesses say at least 10 waves of Israeli jets pounded refugee camps and the area near the main headquarters of the PLO. It was the third and most damaging raid in the past 6 weeks, while Israel said the hour-long raid was in retaliation for the shooting of its ambassador to Britain. The PLO denied that its people were involved in that attack. The PLO responded with anti-aircraft fire as the jets swooped down on Beirut and later sent Katyusha rockets pouring on Israeli settlements along the border. Ambulances screamed throughout Beirut, carrying dead and wounded to nearby hospitals. The PLO puts the casualties at 35 dead, but the toll is expected to rise as victims are found in the rubble. The PLO poured smoke bombs throughout the city to camouflage targets after the initial assault, and Palestinian gunmen seem prepared for another round, despite the 10-month-old truce here in Lebanon.
Today's attack shatters the truce between Israel and the Palestinians. When U.S. envoy Philip Habib arrives here next week, he will have to try to put together whatever pieces remain of that ceasefire. Chris Harper, ABC News, Beirut.
This is Bill Siemens in Israel. Almost immediately after the Israeli airstrike, Palestinian rockets and artillery shells fired from Lebanon into northern Israel damaged buildings, killed one Israeli, and wounded at least four others. It was the PLO answer to the Israeli air raid. As loudspeaker cars and troops urged residents to go down into their bomb shelters, Israeli artillery fired back, and tonight there seemed to be little hope for the ceasefire as the level of violence rises. The Israelis have repeatedly warned that they will not tolerate attacks like this at home, and they claim that they are now facing a new wave of terrorism against their diplomats abroad. The critical question tonight is whether the Israelis will now launch a ground attack against the PLO in Lebanon, less than 3 weeks before Prime Minister Begin is scheduled to meet President Reagan in Washington. Bill Siemens, ABC News, Tel Aviv.
Good evening from Versailles. The ornate palace outside Paris, where the end of the seven-nation economic summit today was completely overshadowed by an Israeli invasion of Lebanon. Israeli tanks and troops, backed by air and sea bombardment, crossed into Lebanon before dawn. The aim, to destroy Palestinian guerrilla bases. And although hope was being expressed everywhere that there be no contact between the Israeli force and the Syrian force stationed in Lebanon, there is a report from Beirut tonight from the Syrian command that there has been a contact between Israeli and Syrian soldiers. We have two reports on the early fighting, beginning with Chris Harper in Beirut.
Warplanes pounded Palestinian targets in Lebanon again today as Israel launched a full-scale invasion against the PLO. The Palestinians say they downed three Israeli jets and one helicopter in the fighting and put more than one dozen tanks out of commission. Early this morning, over 300 Israeli tanks and personnel carriers poured through UN peacekeeping forces, launching a three-pronged attack on PLO strongholds in Tyre, Nabatea, and Shabaa. The aim of the invasion was to push the PLO farther north to stop missile attacks into Israel. In Sidon, the Palestinians celebrated the death of one Israeli pilot shot down during the massive airstrikes. The body was shown to angry mobs in the city. The PLO claims that three other pilots were killed and one captured in the fighting, the fiercest since Israel launched a similar invasion 4 years ago. The airstrikes continued for the third day in a row as casualties mounted on both sides. Over 300 people have died so far here, and there are fears that the toll will be even higher as the Israelis push north. But the PLO holds strong positions in southern Lebanon, and many observers here think that Israel will suffer heavy losses, even if they are successful in their objectives. Chris Harper, ABC News, Beirut.
This is Bill Seaman.
Strangely enough, even though the Saudis had no formal relations with Israel, they did concoct a deal in which they were going to supply arms to Sudan and also create a rebellious uprising in Libya and also upset the transition of the Iranian government, which was taken over by Ayatollah and Islamic clerics in 79 when the Shah was ousted. So the Saudis have pretty much been in alignment with Western powers and Israel. They just don't have formal relations between themselves. Now, things were a lot more tense in Lebanon back in 1982 when there was a Syrian occupation of Lebanon. And as you could see from this last video, there was a lot of fighting going on right within those the southern Lebanese area where the PLO had an advantage. The PLO was a lot more overt back then. Right now, Israel in modern day times in 2015 has the upper hand. The PLO is practically crippled by fortified gates, limited transportation, limited material goods going into the region. Israel has a stronghold in the Middle East right now, especially with its new Iron Dome defense system, which is an anti-missile system which is designed to deflect mid-range and long-range missiles towards the country. Now, with the instability of ISIS attacking the region and people's disappointment of Bashar al-Assad in the Syrian situation, there's going to be much more international involvement in the upcoming months, given the fact that ISIS is killing people from different countries that really have no particular direct involvement, like Japan and Jordan, and that's only going to fan the flames more. I am ending the show about 5 minutes early. I hope you enjoyed some tidbits of the Middle East tonight and got some insight onto the region. Thank you for joining me on Blog Talk Radio. We generally have 2 shows a week in the middle of the night on Wednesday and Sunday evening. Please feel free to leave your comments at 218-464-1578. We appreciate callers into our show as well.